Good evening, one and all. Yes, a Tuesday, and this is me, Barry, with another book and a chat. Well, I was looking in a paper today, and it was going on about they're sort of doing a ladies-only Grand Prix, perhaps circuit starting up and stuff like that, and it's amazing how finally, after many, many years, the parts that women did in developing, not just sport, but even life itself, are finally getting recognised. It was only, I think it's under 5 years ago, I think, that the women who used to deliver the Spitfires and Hurricanes during the Second World War, you know, when they had to be delivered to the various aerodromes, they finally got recognised. And the ladies in the Land Army that kept the farms going while the people were away and the war kept going. But then you go back to the First World War, and of course the flying was in its early days of the Camels and the SE-5s and the Albatrosses, and of course other places as well. But in America, people were learning to fly on a plane called a Curtiss. Curtiss, I think it was JN-4. JN-4. Now, what could we call that for? Of course, they became the Jennies, named as the Jennies. Well, after the war, you know, the days of the barnstorming, and as the film goes, you know, those magnificent men in their flying machines, up, diddly up, down, diddly up, down. But it wasn't just the men. It was the women as well. And my guest today, she has written a book because her mother was one of these, such one of these women, these early flying lady flyers. But we'll find out a bit more about that, because on the show today, I have journalists, author, playwright, and now a guest on this show, the one and only Theasa Tui. Hi, Theasa, how are you doing?
I'm fine.
Well, I tried it.
You're right about the JN4. They called it a Jenny.
Right, because I know there was a 4 and then the 5s and then a different thing with the OX 5 engines and the OX 2 engines and stuff like that. But it was basically what everybody learned to fly in, I should have think, in the First World War, in America and Canada, I thought, anyway.
Yeah, that was it, definitely, that Jenny was used as a trainer for World War One pilots. And once the war was over, it was wonderful war surplus for the barnstormers. It was a very maneuverable plane. It was very easy to fly, and it was cheap. Buying it as war surplus. So
I think I was looking at, it was like $5,000 new, you know, or something like that, or whether that's now, or no, it might have been back then. But yeah, so I mean, and that was new. That was not the war surplus, like you're saying.
Well, no, I don't know what. No, they were. I think they were definitely a lot cheaper than that.
Oh, perhaps that's what it is now.
It might be.
Right.
Because I was at the Rhinebeck Aerodrome Museum a few months ago to do a reading, and I was walking around in the museum and was flabbergasted to see the very model of the plane that my mother learned to fly in. And it was something like, it gave the price, and it was under $3,000 brand new.
Wow.
And it was this one was not a war surplus. I mean, this was a special plane that was meant basically for doing stunts.
Right, because, I mean, yeah, obviously, they were made for training and stuff like that, so they had to be easy to fly, they had to be maneuverable, they had to be strong, mm-hmm. and easy to put back together, I'd have thought. So it was ideal, as you say, post-war, for this barnstorming stuff, which everybody was, you know, into at the time. I mean, it was huge crowds every time the barnstorm, you know, the plane circuses came to town, sort of thing.
Yeah, no, it was, there were huge news stories all the time. I was just flabbergasted when I started doing a lot of research, and it was amazing. I mean, the news stories were filled with the stunts that these pilots were doing all the time, setting records, setting altitude records, because nothing else was going on. They didn't have television.
Yeah.
They, you know, and this was, people would go out and stand in the airfield or stand in the runways, and they were a big danger to the pilots because they would get in the way.
Yeah, I can imagine. You know, a plane lands and they all rush out to it. Crikey. You see it in, yes, the, in the, you see it in the sort of early movies. You know, these people,
right,
you know, doing this flight and this flight and the races and everything they had in those days. You know, the first, I don't know, London to Paris and all this, you know, this stuff. And you see these people, let alone, you know, the danger of the plane and everything like that, you know, rushing out, getting in the way of everything.
Right, right. Well, that was one of the things that made the research for this book so much fun, was finding out how totally different things were. Well, we're talking 90 years ago,
right,
basically,
yeah,
but
yeah,
it was just absolutely incredible, the things they could do with those planes and the things that they got away with.
Right.
The planes were light. A lot of them were, in the early days, they were made out of wood. So
yeah,
even though these people would have their crash landings, no one would get hurt.
Right, yeah. Yeah. I mean, you hear about that, you know, that you see the things, you know, the early films and stuff like that. And these planes go, and these people just get up and walk away. It's just, as you say, it was wooden, you know, and covered over
I've got
wood.
I've got a crazy story in my book about that I actually found out of a news story, and I couldn't believe it. I just could not believe this happened, but it actually happened. A stunt guy hanging off a rope ladder, dangling from a flying airplane, trying to land on a Brahma bull.
Oh my goodness!
At a rodeo.
I was yesterday I was watching something, they were talking about what are the most dangerous occupations, you know, and you know, they said, you know, like people who test parachutes and that, but it's not the, there's also one worse, and that's when in the early days of the Antarctic, you know, when people were sort of going up there and setting up the camps and stuff, they used to go up with a parachute, if you like. The plane used to come over, and there was like a great big hook thing, and they used to catch the person in their parachute and pull them up into the plane.
Oh God!
That's
one I never heard of.
No, you know, you hear about the wing walking and the people doing all these crazy stunts.
Right.
I mean, obviously the fact that your mother, you know, was one of these early flyers, that's the whole what led you to this book, obviously.
Well, yes and no. There are two main characters. One's a tabloid news reporter, and the other one was a female stunt pilot. And
okay,
they're very, very different. So that's kind of the tension in the book, is the difference between these two women. But my point was, women have been doing things for a long time.
Exactly.
I mean,
yep.
They were flying airplanes in 1929, and not very many of them were in newsrooms, but there were some.
Well, of course, that's one of the things you've done. You know, the first, you know, city editor, Detroit News, and copy there.
No, the assistants.
Assistant. I've just given you a promotion. Don't worry.
I know.
Assistant. Anyhow, copy desk. I mean, you have always pushed, you know, being a lady within a man's world, basically, in the days of the press and that, and obviously taking on from your mother.
Yeah, I would say so. I'm also from the Southwest, and you know, that's how the West was won. The women got out and did their share too.
Right, you had to, yeah, right, yeah. It's indeed so. I mean, and again, you know, people don't realize the part that women played in a lot of this. It's just starting, I think, you're starting to see some of this come through in sort of films and documentaries and stuff like that. But it was a fact that, you know, these early days of discovery, the flying, the this, that, and the other, women were there.
Oh, absolutely. You know, women have been doing things for a long time, and that was one of the points of my book, is that if you set your mind to something, you can go do it.
Right, because it's not your first book, is it? Because you had The 5 O'Clock Follies, was that your other
one? Yes, the 5 O'Clock Follies was about a a woman correspondent during the Vietnam War, specifically at the time of the Tet Offensive. And there were women in Vietnam, but not a lot, not a lot. Right. And, it was a bit of a tough go to manage it, but there were enough of them that did it that, it's a good story.
Yeah, one of the great things I love doing about this show, and I've been doing it about 5-6 years now, is that the stuff you find out. You know, that I remember I had a lady written a book about a female platoon in the American Civil War. You know,
it's not surprising. Yeah. It's really not surprising. As I said, women have been doing things for a very long time. And, but my point with this was usually the women in the old movies and books, usually the women that were heroines rather than heroes.
Yeah.
They were usually picking up a gun to save their farm or save their children or something like that. And, I decided that it was time for women to do stuff they just wanted to do for the fun of it or because it was a job they liked to do.
It's amazing how these things get changed around as well. I was watching something earlier on this week, and they were saying that the idea of the woman being tied to the railway track, you know, and the hero coming along and releasing her, never actually appeared in any film. What was the female rescued the hero from the railroad track. But over the time, and it's not, you know, not in any film did it ever appear, but over the time that's become the sort of the theme, but it wasn't, it was the other way around. The book itself, as you said, the two characters, so you've got the contrast of the two between the journalist and the flyer. Is that what you like putting in, you know, characters to feed off, you know, backwards and forward off each other? Is that something you like bringing into your stories?
No, not necessarily. It was just this. Basically, I set out to indicate that women were doing what so-called men's jobs in 1929. That's when the book was set. It was set during the first year, the first Powder Puff Derby, which was the first time women were allowed into the Transcontinental Air Race.
Right, yes, yes.
And the race was from Santa Monica, California to Cleveland, and it took 9 days.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, well, they would fly for, they had a specific route that they flew, and they would fly in the morning and land in the afternoon, then have big luncheons and big speeches. Everyone would come out from town to greet them,
right.
And then they'd take off the next day. So it was a timed race, actually. And, you know, no one could fly at night in those days,
right.
Because there were no lights on airfields.
Right.
And most of these women were flying in open cockpit planes, so they were flying through wind and rain and storm, whatever. The woman who won the race, a woman by the name of Louise Seddon, referred to it as the Sunburn Derby.
Oh, I could imagine. Yes.
Yeah.
Open top sitting there. Oh, crikey, you come off with the right Santa.
Right. Yeah, Will Rogers was the one who dubbed it the Powder Puff Derby. It had some long name, you know, the Women's Transcontinental Air Races or something like that. But Will Rogers, who was a humorist and movie star at the time, and also wrote a humorous newspaper column, referred to it as the Powder Puff Derby. So that's where the name came from.
Right, it's amazing. And of course, I mean, even though it's just come out recently, it's already made the New York Times. Yeah,
my book?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I did get a mention.
There you go.
In the Times, yeah.
That's not bad, is it?
Yeah, that's good.
So what's the response been to it since it's come out?
It's very hard to say. Who knows who's buying the book and who's buying it on Kindle?
Well,
But everyone that reads it seems to love it. That people, it's a lot of fun. You know, it's just, it's a lot of fun. So it's a jolly story, and you know, these women are from two completely disparate backgrounds. I mean, one's from the Southwest and the other one grew up in Bohemian free love,
oh, right.
Free Republic, Greenwich Village. So these women couldn't have been more different. They just simply couldn't have been more different. So, you know, they started out not getting along at all. And the reporter goes to cover, the stunt pilot flies under all four of New York's East River bridges. And that actually happened. That was done by a woman by the name of Eleanor Smith when she was 17 years old.
I remember hearing about her, yes.
Yeah. She took off from Roosevelt Field when it was more than a shopping center. And flew under the bridges. It was a stunt that had never been done before and never been done since. So the tabloid reporter from New York, that's how they first meet. Is
oh, right.
That the reporter is covering this goofy stunt. Everybody, all the bridges were jammed with spectators and newsreel cameramen watching this crazy stunt, because no one thought it could be done. It was a very difficult thing to do.
I bet, yeah.
I mean, at some point there was like 200 feet clearance between a bridge and the water. So to be able to navigate that was just an amazing feat.
Yeah.
And when you think it was a teenage girl that did it.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, I mean,
then the reporter ends up, you know, following, going to the Powderpuff Derby in Cleveland, and they have all sorts of adventures of stealing airplanes and
oh,
lots
crack
of fun.
It, yeah, I bet. I think it's wonderful that you're able to bring us. And of course, obviously, you know, your mother was around, did the same sort of things. I mean, didn't she know Wiley Post? Because he was the first person to fly around the world, wasn't he?
He was trying to fly around the world when he was killed.
Oh, so he didn't quite make it. Okay.
He didn't quite make it. Yeah, but actually, my mother did know Wiley Post. My father was the one who knew a lot of the aviators, and that's, for some reason, my mother just decided she wanted to fly. She thought that would be a fun thing to do.
Wow.
So the two of them hung out with Paul Braniff, who started Braniff Airways.
Mm-hmm.
And Wiley Post was part of that crowd to some extent. Wiley Post was a different sort of character, but anyway, he and Will Rogers were trying to fly around the world, and they crashed in Alaska.
Oh, crikey, so, yeah. Can you imagine flying in an open cockpit plane in those?
No,
I don't think so. Because
I've
got to say, no. Flying over Alaska in an open cockpit plane?
No.
It's bad enough with even these days with icing on the wings and stuff like that.
Right.
Your new books is a series which is something totally different, isn't it? Set in France, a mystery series.
Right. Well, that's a mystery series that I'm working on. I'm just finishing up the second one. I haven't found a publisher yet for the mystery series. I thought it would be better to have written two before I approached a publisher and tried to... They all seem to want a series, so if you got two of them going, then...
Yeah, it's a good start, because otherwise they say, well, there's one, how is the second one going to be? But yeah, I've heard that lots of people. It's good to have two there so that they can get an idea how the story is going. But again...
And the mysteries are very frivolous. They're just totally a lot of fun.
Oh, good.
it's like I went from war to serious female pilot, and now it's like just a goofy, wacky, quirky mystery series set in Paris with a bunch of American expats.
Well, there you go. I mean, that's great that you can cover so many things, because it's not just these. Of course, you've also done a musical, or the book based on what, D.H. Lawrence?
D.H. Lawrence, yeah, who's also a pretty serious subject.
Oh my goodness, yes.
Yeah, people always said, how in the world can you write a musical about D.H. Lawrence? He was very serious and very grumpy. But, yeah, no, I just worked on the script, on the libretto for that. Another friend of mine did the lyrics, and we worked on the book together. But we produced it a couple of times in England, and it had a 2-week run in New Orleans.
Oh, there you go.
yeah. No, that was certainly something different.
I bet down there. Going back to the Flying Jenny, you know, the book we're talking about, the one that's just come out recently and everything. Have you ever flown one or flown in one?
No. And I'm. The closest I've come was I did a reading out at the Air Museum in Long Island, and I stood underneath a Jenny when I did my reading. And I stood by a Jenny when I did a reading at the Rhinebeck Aerodrome, but I've been up once or twice in small planes, but it's not for me.
I was going to say, it's a little bit old now.
I prefer the typewriter or the computer.
Right. It's great, because, I mean, it's great that, you know, especially obviously from England, we still get the fly paths and that of the, mainly the Second World War, the Battle of Britain fights and stuff like that. But they still see the odd, you know, the odd First World War plane occasionally. They sort of just have it on some of the big ones going up. And even now, you look at it and you think, I would never go up in something like that.
Oh, yeah. No, they're unbelievable. I did a story. I worked for the Associated Press for a long time, and I did a story, a big feature story once on my mother. And so I was interviewing my mother, and I took her out to a museum, and we were looking at these old planes, and I couldn't believe it. I'm like, what the people called the cockpit where they sat was just like a hole in a tin can almost, you know?
And no wonder, you know, no wonder they all had the sort of jackets, the fleece jackets and the scarves and the big gloves on there, because as you say, you're open to the elements, you know. People know
totally.
You know how bad it is sometimes in an open top car. Well, imagine an open top car up in the air, but without a windscreen.
Right.
And there's you in a little tin can squashed in.
Right. No. I mean, it really was just, it was just sort of a hole cut in the fuselage. Amazing. And my mother was tiny when she was always tiny, but she was certainly tiny when she was flying. And she used to fly with a pillow behind her.
Really?
Because she never wanted to be a stunt pilot. She always worried when they turned upside down, when they were flying upside down, that she'd just fall out, you know?
So what did she do? Did she do, like, mail flying and stuff like that?
Oh, no. She strictly, I mean, you know, she was like a weekend golfer or something.
Oh, right, a weekend flyer.
she just flew for the fun of it. But she had a pilot's license. She was got a letter from Amelia Earhart asking her to join the women's aviation group that was formed after that first Powder Puff Derby. It's called the 99s, and is still in existence. It's the women's organization for female pilots.
Amazing.
So, it takes a long time to get a license to be able to solo it. So she did a lot of flying.
Right.
She certainly, in fact, there were very few jobs during that period. I mean, it was right during that period that they even got Congress to agree to allow them to carry some of the mail in airplanes. Mm. I mean, all this was very, very young and developmental at that point.
Right. Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, you know, you see the odd things, you know, about it and that even now, but you still have really no idea just how it was. And especially, as you say, that the part the women played in it.
Yeah, no, it is sort of surprising to a lot of people that there were that many. I think there were 112 or 116 women that had pilot license at that time that women's organization was created. And the reason they call it the 99s is because Amelia Earhart sent out letters to all the women that held a license in the United States. And as I said, people give different numbers, but it was 112 or 116 women that got those letters, and only 99 responded.
Well,
so
that's how they got the name 99.
That's how they got the name 99.
Wow. See, I've learned something else, you see.
You know what the 99s
exactly.
are and why they got their name.
And I've also learned how great it is having a chat with you. It's been fascinating talking to you about the book and about the history and everything like that. But what I'm going to do now, Tiesa, is hand the show over to you so you can tell everybody where they can find out more about you, your books, and everything else. So over to you.
Okay. Well, it's pretty simple. I have a website with my name, and because my name's so unusual, it's just my name. Anybody else has to add a 4 or an NYC or something like that to their website. Mine is TheAsatuohy.com.
Great.
And you'll find information about all my books and some storylines of Flying Jenny and a lot of press reports. And that's about it. And you can find me on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or wherever you buy your books.
And also, there is a picture of the plane going under the bridges in New York there, I noticed, on the on one of your links
on
there.
The website.
Yeah, on the website.
On the website. Yeah, that is Eleanor Smith, the 17-year-old, flying that was taken by a Daily News photographer, I think.
Wow.
And speaking of the Daily News, they're going to have I have an op-ed piece running in the Daily News, New York Daily News, on Sunday.
Great.
Talking about Eleanor Smith, because Sunday is the 90th anniversary of her bridge stunt.
Amazing. So, it really is amazing when you see this stuff, and you just wonder how people are still around. But
that's what historical novels are for.
Exactly.
Is to learn real history with fictional characters, and there's a lot of real characters in both my a lot of real people also, but the main characters are fictional, but they are put into totally accurate historical accounts. So, good way to learn your history.
Indeed it is. Well, we've learned a lot today. Thank you so much for being a guest on the show. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you.
Well, there you go. My guest today, Tiesa Tuohy. Now, I'll spell that again because that's her website, as she said. It's T-H-E-A-S-A, Tiesa, and then Tuohy is T-U-O-H-Y. So it's T-H-E-S-A-T-O-U-H-Y. There you go. That's great, isn't it? Fantastic. See, I love it when we learn these things that people just forgotten about over the times, and it brings us back to the spotlight and everything like that. And as you say, it's already been mentioned in New York Times. Great stuff. Well, I'll be back tomorrow, but until then, as always, I have one thing left to say. Don't forget...